Your next speaker is Avon Malone.
Just a few melancholy ruins to the Roman god Silvanus. It's true that in 42 B.C. a momentous battle was fought there. The forces of Mark Antony and Octavius met and were defeated by Brutus and Cassius and their forces. It's true that Philip, the father of Alexander the Great, gave his name to Philippi. And it's true, as we note in Acts the 16th chapter, verse 11 and following, that it was a Roman colony. There were certain mines not far away, actually close by, that were very rich for a time. And yet it's for none of these reasons that we call to mind a particular place, a place which is hardly represented upon the face of this earth in a material or physical way now. And yet not a week passes, in fact not a day passes, but what reference is made to Philippi. It's not because of the famed battle fought there. It's not because of some of these other things that we've mentioned. But the continuing renown of that particular place, prominent in the ancient past, can be attributed to the fact that Paul wrote a letter to a group of Christians there. We introduced our study of it yesterday and suggested that in chapter 1 we have the Christian's purpose to live is Christ, verse 21. In chapter 2 we have the Christian's pattern, the mind of Christ, which is of course the self-emptying mind. He emptied himself, verse 7 of chapter 2. And this is the mind of verse 5 in chapter 2. And that's the Christian's pattern, the mind of self-renunciation. In chapter 3, we have the Christian's prize. In chapter 3, 13 and 14, Paul speaks of pressing toward the mark for the prize of the high calling of God in Christ. And finally, in the fourth chapter, and one toward which we move with eager anticipation, this may well be, in many respects, the most personally helpful section of the book. In chapter 4, we have the Christian's provision. Chapter 1, purpose, to live is Christ. Chapter 2, pattern, the mind of Christ, the self-emptying mind. Chapter 3, the Christian's prize, the prize of the high calling or the upward call of God in Christ. And chapter 4, the Christian's provision. Paul thanks them warmly for their gift. And then he goes on to say, "My God will supply every need of yours, all your needs, according to His riches in glory in Christ Jesus." Chapter 4, 19. And then in 4 and 13, "I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me." Now let's come back to our study in chapter 1. And we've divided the first chapter like this, verses 3 through 11, in chapter 1, Paul's prayer. We have here a great praise prayer. Brother R.C. Bell said that spiritual dwarfs do not pray that other men might be spiritual giants. This being true, and I think that it no doubt is, Paul is a giant and he prays that the Philippians might share in this. He prays in verses 9 through 11 that their love might abound. Yet more and more in knowledge and in all discernment, that you may approve the things that are excellent, that you may be sincere, void of offense unto the day of Christ, being filled with the fruits of righteousness, which are through Jesus Christ unto the glory of God. This is the close of the great praise prayer from verses 3 through 11. In 12 through 26, chapter 1, 12 through 26, we have a section that I like to call Paul's poise. Paul's poise. Here's power, mastery, composure, courage, adequacy and sufficiency in Christ as seen in the face of imprisonment, which is about the first thing that Paul mentions here, starting with verse 12. We see his poise in the face of the mixed and on the part of some inferior motives of some who are preaching the gospel, preaching Christ out of envy and strife. And we see Paul's poise in the face of the possibility of his death. Paul insists that to live, to abide in the flesh, means fruitful labor, the fruit of my labor. But to depart, literally to be loosed and be with Christ, is very far better. And so we have Paul's great poise. And this is one of the bracing, thrilling parts of this vibrant and vital letter. And then finally, in 26 through 30, verses 27 really, 27 through 30, we have Paul's plea. A plea for unity, a plea for oneness, a plea for cohesive standing together, standing fast for the faith of the gospel, a plea for dauntlessness and bravery and courage, in nothing being terrified by your adversaries. Phillips has it, not caring two straws for your adversaries. Don't be then afraid of them. Their persecution is an evident token of their perdition, but of your salvation, and that from God. So you stand fast, having the same conflict, the chapter closes, which you saw to be in me and now here to be in me. Paul's prayer, Paul's poise, Paul's plea. This will pretty well divide and break down the structure here in chapter 1. Let's notice in the very heart of this great prayer, verse 6, and I talked about this briefly yesterday, being confident of this very thing, that he who began a good work in you will perfect it unto the day of Jesus Christ. Historically, much of our preaching from the past was a kind of polemic against Calvinism, and this was necessary. When the Restoration took root in this country, Calvinism was the dominant theology. It was necessary to point out that God's grace is not irresistible grace, that man's will is free and that he can resist. It was necessary to point out that one having received God's grace and obeying the gospel could thereafter fall from his grace. Calvinism denied that, placing all the stress on the sovereignty of God and the power and plan of God. The Calvinist insisted that if God chose to save a man, once saved, always saved. And so we opposed that, and rightfully so. But in the process, we may have left the impression with some, as we stress such passages as Acts 2 and 40, save yourselves from this wicked generation or this underworld generation. Work out, as we have here in Philippians 2, your own salvation. And we didn't say much about that next verse, for it is God who worketh in you, both to will and to do of His good pleasure. And I best work out by continuing my obedient trust and dependence upon that one who is able to keep me from falling, Jude 24, that one who is able to save to the uttermost, Hebrews 7:25. And so you see, God works in us. And in this letter, we see a tremendous emphasis upon divine activity. I'm confident. Paul is not saying here, and the third chapter will clear this up because Paul makes it apparent, I've got to continue to press on. I do not count myself to have yet apprehended or laid hold upon the ultimate prize. And so I've got to continue to press on. Even a denominational writer, Carol Simcox, in a book entitled They Met at Philippi, a very fine devotional commentary on the book of Philippians, points out in this third chapter that if a man looks upon his ultimate salvation as a completely settled issue right now, he claims more for himself than Paul did for himself. We can fall. And Paul in verse 6 here is not saying that we cannot, but he is saying that God will do His part. And if we will continue in obedient trust and faith to thrust ourselves and the weight of our souls and the weight of our guilt upon the Christ, and trust in this God who began a good work and who will complete it, He'll do exactly that. And the fruition of our hope we can one day enjoy. So I'm confident that He who began a good work, the exact language here is the language that would describe the sacrificial ritual. You start the sacrifice and you complete it. God begins it and God will perfect it under the day of Christ. A man stood in an AA meeting and he said, I once had a watch. Very remarkable timepiece. It had a chronometer on it, had everything but hot and cold running water. But I found out one thing. I couldn't repair that watch. An ordinary watch repairman could not repair that watch. And when anything went wrong with it, I had to just give it back to its original maker. And it dawned on me that my life was like that, desperately out of tune and urgently in need of repair. And I could not, in and of myself, repair it. I just had to give it back to the original maker. Paul, in effect, is saying, you've done that. And if you'll continue in that same obedient trust, God will complete His work. I pray then, verse 9, dropping down now to that, you might follow in your testament, that your love may abound. This is the word agape for love that lies beneath sentiment and emotion and involves the fixing of the will. Jesus said, love your enemies, Matthew chapter 5, 43, 44. Why? The passage there in Matthew 5 goes on to teach that you might be like your Father. What's He like? He sends His Son upon the just and unjust, His reign upon the just and unjust. He wills the very best for every man. And thus you are to love. And let that love, Paul writes here, abound. The word is parasuo in the language of the New Testament, and this means to overflow, to go over and above. We don't dole out our love in little perfunctory pinches, but like a mighty cascade or waterfall, it's to overflow. There's a great lesson there that would cure the malady of the minimum in the church, you know. How much do I have to do? How much do I have to attend? This is love toward God and man, I'm convinced. In fact, John insists that love for God and love for man are indivisible. That each is the test of the other. And if a fellow says, I love God, there's a test for that. Do you love your brother, you see? Paul is saying that this love, and I'm sure he's particularly concerned about the manifestation of it toward brethren, because later he talks about Euodia and Syntyche in chapter 4, 2. The very kind of tension and problem that we sometimes have. But if our love overflows, goes over and abound in knowledge and in discernment, approving the things that are excellent or the things that differ, then this kind of love, coupled with knowledge and discernment, by the way, that's the knowledge of relationship. Make a note of chapter 3, verse 10, that I may know Him and the power of His resurrection. It's the knowledge of experience and relationship. And the love that abounds in knowledge and discernment is a kind of solvent and solution for the tensions that sometimes threaten the fellowship of Christians. Now look at verse 12. Paul is saying here, there's something I want you to know, brethren. There's some things that have happened to me. And I know on the surface they look bad, but they haven't been bad, they're good. The things that have happened to me have fallen out unto the furtherance or unto the progress of the gospel. The word translated progress or furtherance is a word which in other contexts could describe the ongoing march of an army over rugged terrain, the hacking away of the underbrush, the overcoming of the obstacles, but the continued forward movement. We have here a tremendous truth. Paul is at this time a prisoner. In these prison letters, he talks about his bonds, as he does in the very next verse. My bonds in Christ are made manifest throughout the palace or the whole Praetorian Guard. You have this expression in Ephesians 6:20, an ambassador in bonds. He says of Onesimus, whom I have begotten in my bonds. And in this word bonds, he uses a word that would describe a relatively short link of chain or bit of chain. One end of which would be affixed to the prisoner, the other end of which would be attached to a guard, which guard would be changed periodically. That's the kind of situation Paul's in. What would it be like to be chained to Paul? Well, you'd hear about Jesus. And I'm sure the Praetorian Guard had become pretty well acquainted, many of them at least, with this Christ. But think about the fact there's been no highway traversed. There's been no body of water traversed. Here, this great night of the cross is not at the present time moving into virgin fields that have previously been untouched by the gospel. He's confined. But you know what he's saying? This is good because God is working in this. The things that have happened have fallen out under the furtherance of the gospel. I said this yesterday. Let me repeat it. It, in effect, is something that was said by Mr. Ralph Parlett in the little book, The University of Hard Knocks. It's not the size of the bump, but the attitude of the bumpee that determines whether we're made bitter or better. You give Paul a lemon and he makes lemonade. If I might use an illustration a bit more crude, when he finds a worm in his apple, he just has fish for dinner. You may not like that, but at any rate, Paul could use the prunings of providence. And this is not just the power of positive thinking. I'm not quite like the fellow that said I find Peel appalling and Paul appealing. I wouldn't go quite that far. Peel has said some good things, a lot of which he borrowed from Paul. But I know that here this is not just the power of positive thinking. This is Paul saying and confidently believing that God is at work. And the fact that I am now a prisoner, probably in Rome, chapter 4:22 seems to indicate that, as well as 1:13. The fact that I am now a prisoner is good, you see. The thwartings have become thoroughfares. The bonds have actually removed certain barriers. The adversity has been turned to advantage, and the difficulties have opened certain doors. And we stand back in amazement. How in the world could this be? And before we answer that, let me remind you, Paul never writes under the circumstances. Now, you and I talk like that, and you and I think like that, and I imagine that sometimes you and I write like that, or at least are inclined to write like that, but Paul doesn't, because he never was under the circumstances. In the power and providence of the living Christ, he was always right on top of them and quite convinced that even a prisoner in Rome, he's being bountifully blessed by God and this is being used to the furtherance of the gospel. But how? Well, he gives us two reasons. One in 13 and one in verse 14. In 13, my bonds in Christ are made manifest throughout the palace. It may be that a better rendering throughout the whole Praetorian, that would be the Imperial Guard. Augustus started this Imperial Guard made up of 9 or 10 cohorts of men, most of whom would have been quartered in Rome. And Paul is saying, my bonds in Christ. I'm not a political criminal. I'm not a malefactor, and they know this. My bonds are in Christ. And that truth has been made manifest throughout the whole Praetorian and to all the rest. And so this thing is actually working for the furtherance of the gospel. And not only that, but most of the brethren are become more abundantly bold to speak the word without fear. Verse 14. And that's what we need. That's what we need during this meeting, and that's what it's going to take to evangelize. And Paul said that's what's happened here. But then he goes on to say that while some preach Christ of goodwill and of love, knowing that I'm set for the defense of the gospel, others preach Christ of envy and strife. I do not believe that he's here talking about the Judaizers. Later he does. Later in chapter 3, 2, when he talks about beware of the dogs, beware of the evil workers, beware of the concision, I think clearly he has in mind the Judaizers, those who would bind circumcision even upon Gentile converts. But that's not it here, because Paul said they preach Christ. That's not the way Paul would talk about the message of the Judaizers. They preach Christ. And so here we have nothing wrong with the message, but on the part of some, something wrong with their motives. I don't draw the conclusion here that motive is not important. It is. And wrong motives can be terribly destructive to the one who is motivated wrongly. But Paul does find something here in which he can rejoice. Christ is preached, and I therein rejoice, yea, and will rejoice. Now watch this part of the letter. Paul comes on down to say that this will work to my salvation. This will turn out to my deliverance, my salvation. You might compare this with Job 13:16. In the Greek translation of the Old Testament scriptures, in the Septuagint, the language in Job 13:16 is very much like Paul's language when he talks about this will turn out to my salvation, to my deliverance, through your supplication and the supply of the Spirit of Jesus Christ. Paul seems to be saying, I will be vindicated. There will be deliverance. But there is some uncertainty as to whether or not that deliverance will be by means of death or whether I'll abide in the flesh. A bit later, in about verse 26, he says, I know that I will abide, yea, abide with you all, 25 and 26. But it is at this point that Paul discusses a dilemma. The dilemma is not like that pictured by Hamlet in the famed soliloquy in which he said, to be or not to be, that's the question. Of course, really, that's not the question, because once you are, you never cease to be. But Hamlet was trying to decide between two bitters, whether to take up arms against the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, that is, to go on living, and that wasn't a very pleasant contemplation, or to die, and he dreaded and feared that. Now, Paul's dilemma here is altogether different, and Paul is not saying the choice is with me, but if it were, I would have a real dilemma before me. And I keep using this word dilemma. Moffat and Weymouth translate it like that. Our more common translation, with which we're more familiar, would have it, I am in a strait betwixt two. One time on a test up at Bear Valley, I asked the question, what was Paul's attitude toward life and toward death in Philippians 1? And one fellow said, Paul was in a twixt between two straits. Very fine young man, and a fellow who ordinarily was rather eloquent with his tongue, but he kind of had a little trouble with his pen that day. Paul was in a twixt between two straits. Well, Paul said, I'm in a strait betwixt two. Having the desire to depart, this is a form of analusis or analuane, depending on whether you have the noun or the verb form, and we have a form of the verb or infinitive here. I have a desire to depart. And this really means to loose. In some context, it might describe the loosing of the mooring ropes, or the loosing of the tent ropes as the military camp is broken up, or the falling of the fetters that hold the captives or the slaves. And in a figure or metaphorically, this can mean the solving of problems. You know what Paul is saying death is? And he uses a form of this word, the noun form, in 2 Timothy chapter 4. The time of my departure, there's that word again. My loosing is at hand. You know what Paul is saying? He's saying death is a loosing. This is a breaking of the camp. This is a loosing of the mooring ropes. You don't build a great vessel to leave it in the harbor. It's built to go on out to another shore. And Paul said, that's what death is to me. To depart and be with Christ is very far better. But to abide in the flesh is more needful for you. I want to ask you a couple of questions. I'd hope to get a bit further this morning, but we'll talk about some things, among other things, the doctrine New Testament doctrine of suffering as we close this chapter and hurry into chapter 2 tomorrow. But let me ask you a question or two right here quickly. What is it to live? What is life to you? And some would have to honestly say, well, life to me is the amassing of the material. Life to me is the fulfillment of my own pride and the gratification of my own ego, my insatiable desire for a certain position and prestige. What is life to you? Pleasure. I want to drink to the very dregs of pleasure's cup. Well, let me ask you another question. What is it to die? Now, you may react to that by saying, don't talk to me about death. Oscar Levant, the famed musician, said, don't mention death in my presence. I don't want to ever hear that word. William Randolph Hearst, fabulously rich, and yet he said, don't mention the word death in my presence. I don't want to hear that word. What is it to live? And my friend, if you say wealth or pleasure or the fulfillment of my pride and ego, then the next question needs to be, what is it to die? And if you say, don't talk about that, then I suggest to you, my friend, that's the most unreasonable, almost irrational view, because you see, we have an appointment. And when we have appointments, we prepare for them, and it's appointed unto men once to die, Hebrews 9:27. An attitude toward death is inseparably linked with attitude toward life. And before Paul could say death is gain, he had to say living to me simply means Christ. The self-life exchange for the Christ life and Christ living in me, Galatians 2:20. And so here in Philippians 1:21, for to me to live is Christ. Now what is it to live? What is it to die? Ingersoll stood at the graveside of his brother and he said, this life is a narrow veil between the barren peaks of two eternities. We strive in vain to look beyond the heights. We cry aloud and the only answer is the echo of a wailing cry from the voiceless lips of the unreplying dead. There comes no word. You contrast that with the words of Paul. To die is gain, and a choice is ours, my friend. If we can, within our own lives, say and live, to live is Christ, then we can come to that chilling Jordan of death with a measure of assurance that we could never otherwise know as we follow that one who said, I'm the living one, was dead, and am alive forevermore, and I have the keys of death and Hades. Revelation 1:18.